Jenna Ellis. I'm your host, Jenna Ellis, and this is our AFR exclusive podcast on demand where we answer the questions, talk about the issues, host all the guests that you are most interested in hearing about and hearing from. So this week, the biggest issue, of course, is everything that is going on with Trump's mass deportations, how a district judge could possibly suggest that an airplane literally in the middle of the ocean would have to turn around. I mean, does the court even have jurisdiction over international waters? Probably not. But that whole controversy, and then, of course, Representative Brandon Gill and a few others in Congress are now going to file articles of impeachment against this judge for, let's be honest, being political and trying to force his political will over and above actually just enforcing the law, which is what Article III judges should do. And then Chief Justice Roberts, of all people, tried to not be political by being political, which isn't that always his way. And so he issued a statement suggesting that impeachment was not the correct remedy because guess what? We have appellate courts. So district court judges apparently can be as political as they want. They can ignore the law however they want. They don't have to execute their duties of office faithfully because appellate courts will just rush in and save them. And, you know, I am old enough to remember when impeachments were deemed quasi-political during Trump's first and second impeachment because everybody on the left was screaming, including Chief Justice Roberts, by the way, who presided over the trial of the first and second impeachments, and suggested that because the legislative branch in Article One is a political branch, then we don't even need a legal basis in anything. We can just go ahead and impeach whoever we want because it's quasi-political and it's just the political will of the House and the Senate to impeach and convict. But now that it's over a precious Article III judge, who, by the way, is an Obama appointee, now all of a sudden, no, we don't play those kinds of political games. So much to talk about here. And I am so grateful to be joined by the perfect guest for all of his commentary, my dear friend Michael Knowles from The Daily Wire and host of The Michael Knowles Show. He wrote a great blank book that we were talking about right before the show that you absolutely need to read because it's blank, and who doesn't want to read that? So hello, Michael, and thanks so much for joining On Demand.
Well, Jenna, wonderful as always to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so, you know, your initial thoughts on this whole controversy, because I find all of it to just be utterly hilarious how Trump is just executing the executive branch and the right, frankly, of then the power to deport all of these criminal migrants. And then, sorry, judge, you know, the plane's already in the air. Oops, we didn't wait for a court order to do this.
The greatest response, of course, was from Nayib Bukele, the Latin American strongman who is now our partner and is taking our worst, most face-tattooed foreign criminals for us and actually processing them. His response to the judge's statement was, oopsie, too late, with a laughing emoji, and I love that. So at this point, I'm ready to endorse Nayib Bukele, the leader of El Salvador, for a president in 2028. But back on the American front, President Trump obviously was getting ahead of this, understood that there were these kinds of political threats coming from the bench, and so was able to get those flights up in the air and get these criminals deported from the country. I just wonder if he, like I, has whiplash, because I am old enough to remember when, as you just pointed out, Jenna, the Democrats were strenuously arguing that impeachment was a merely political process that did not require any legal predicate. That wasn't so long ago. That was just a few years ago. Now they've changed their minds. I'm old enough to remember when the Democrats were arguing against these kinds of actions, really any kind of muscle from the courts. I'm old enough to remember when you had Chuck Schumer threatening a supposedly co-equal branch of government, saying, we're coming for you, Justice Kavanaugh. We're coming for you, Justice Gorsuch. You've unleashed the whirlwind. I remember that. And now you have these Democrats arguing against political impeachment and for a kind of judicial supremacy. And I think this is the term that really gets to the heart of this matter. You hear the Democrats prattling on and on about the separation of powers and checks and balances and how Trump needs to respect this preposterous judge and his preposterous decision. However, they're not really arguing for checks and balances. They're not arguing for a separation of powers. They are arguing for judicial supremacy so that any two-bit federal judge appointed by some leftist president can trump the president of the United States on even the most basic aspects of the job of the executive branch. And I think, and even if you don't like Trump, even if you don't support the deportations, if you actually support the separation of powers and checks and balances, you cannot allow this judge to get away with that.
Yeah, and they're arguing, though, just for biased judicial supremacy, right? Because when the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, then suddenly, oh, well, that's irrelevant. That's invalid. And when the courts are telling the sanctuary city states, no, you actually have to abide by federal law and let ICE come in and Tom Homan do his thing, then suddenly it's perfectly fine for Gavin Newsom and, you know, some of these mayors of these Democrat cities to object and just say, well, we don't really care what the courts say. So, I mean, so this is not even a fully judicial supremacy argument. I mean, that would be too consistent for the Democrats, right? It's only the outcomes that they prefer. And so I think we are genuinely in a broader constitutional crisis in a sense, because ultimately this can't end well if Democrats and even Republicans just select and prefer which opinions and which authorities they want to abide by depending on the outcome.
Yes. No, I mean, I think that's a great point. The Democrats are arguing for judicial supremacy today, and tomorrow they'll argue for executive supremacy if they get into the presidency. And if they don't have the presidency or the court, they'll argue for legislative supremacy if Chuck Schumer can move the ball down the line. So there's no consistency here. The only through line is power. And unfortunately for them, they don't have power right now. So I'm hearkening back, even though it feels as though the second term has 500 news stories a day. It feels like, you know, it's just been going on for months. But just a few weeks ago, when President Trump was sitting in the Oval Office and he was giving a little tough love to Ukrainian President Zelensky, what his advice came down to is, you don't have the cards. He said, we need to have a peace deal because you don't have the cards. You don't have any real leverage here. And Zelensky didn't want to hear it, but it's true. And I think that's the lesson for the Democrats here. They don't have the cards. They think that some two-bit federal judge, district judge, is going to stop President Trump from fulfilling his campaign promise, the promise that he's campaigned on for 10 years and on which he just won the popular vote in addition to the Electoral College vote. No, that's just not going to happen. So you're going to see all of this kind of fighting, and Republicans are not immune to it either. They'll make different arguments about the role of the courts and the executive based on which offices they're occupying, too. But when the nuts and bolts come down to it, the judge has no teeth. Great presidents have ignored courts on many occasions. I'm thinking notably of Lincoln and FDR, but others as well. And Trump is going to ignore the court here. The question then is, do the Republicans have the chutzpah to actually impeach this judge? And I think there's a chance that they do. You know, the political winds are really at the Republicans' backs. To use Trump's phrase, the Republicans have the cards right now. And so if I were a Democrat, whether it's at the activist level or at a judge level or anywhere in between, I would be very cautious.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. And I fully support impeaching this judge. I actually think the impeachment clause and the power has been exercised too little, because that is a check and balance on the lifetime tenure of Article III judges in particular, and even these executives that have run wild, like Alejandro Mayorkas. He deserved to be impeached. Joe Biden should have been impeached. And yet Republicans don't seem to have the political will or the political stomach to actually exercise legitimate power when they have it, when Democrats exercise power that they don't have all the time. And that's the thing that really bothers me between both of the parties. But in terms of the impeachment itself, I don't think that the judge would actually be convicted and removed at trial, because I don't think that, unfortunately, we have two-thirds of the Senate that will do that. And this is why the midterms are so important. But I do think that impeachment and just forcing that judge to sit for trial and have his lawyers explain why he arrived to this decision and try to at least prevent some kind of defensible argument to this. I think that that is something that this country needs. And if more judges were forced to defend their positions, maybe they would think about not making these kinds of opinions in the first place.
Yes. The only argument against the impeachment of the judge, and you're hearing some of the squish Republicans make it now, is, well, you know, if we impeach this judge now, if we use power in what I think is a just way now, then the next time the Democrats are in charge, they might use power in an unjust way. And so to prevent this hypothetical, we won't do what we really ought to do right now. And as you're alluding to, the silliest part of that argument is the Democrats are already abusing their power. So I don't care about some hypothetical abuse of power in the future. They've already done it when they're really in power. And we don't win by losing. You know, timidity is not going to help us here. So I totally agree. We need to put these sorts of judges in their place, and we need to show that Republicans are actually going to govern. We're actually going to do things. You know, I'm not really joking when I say that the first couple months of this administration, we're not even at a couple months yet. We're just shy of a couple months as we're speaking, and that it's felt like 6 months or a year. Trump has done so much, and he's been bold. He's been with the mass deportations, which is what's triggering this judge and the potential impeachment of the judge. But in so many other things, in DOGE, in gutting the federal government, potentially abolishing the Department of Education, finding so much graft and abuse, bringing peace deals potentially to Ukraine and to Gaza. I mean, it's bold, it's audacious, and the question is, how is he getting away with this? He's getting away with this because this is what he campaigned on. You know, Trump, whatever you say about him, he didn't exactly hide the ball. He was campaigning with Elon Musk. He was campaigning with Tulsi Gabbard and with RFK Jr. and the people that were told are the controversial nominees. He was campaigning on mass deportations. So the people voted for this. They voted for this not only through the mechanism that actually elects our presidents, the Electoral College, but they even voted with the popular vote for mass deportations. The Trump agenda, as he is carrying it out, that is a mainstream political issue now. So the question you have to ask yourself looking at this potential constitutional crisis is, to whom should we defer? The duly and quite popularly elected president, the desires of the American people, the legislators who have also been popularly elected and who also now are Republicans, or some random judge who was appointed by the president two presidents ago and who is clearly exceeding his authority and trying to clobber the other co-equal branches of government. That is not a difficult calculation for me. I think civics 101, I think Schoolhouse Rock is enough to teach you that.
Yes, I know. We should go back to Schoolhouse Rock. Maybe somebody should start posting some of those clips and tagging Chuck Schumer and some of the Democrats and just being like, here, let's take you back, you know, to what we all learned, at least in high school and before that. But you know, it's such a great point that that if there's one criticism of Trump in the first 2 months, it's that he's not even going hard enough. It's like people are saying, mandate harder. I mean, deport more quickly, right. Deport even more. I mean, nobody from the base or the popularity figures. I mean, there was an NBC poll of all polls that said that the Democrats have like a 7% approval rating where people, you know, very strongly like what they stand for right now. That's really low, even for Democrats. And so the vast majority of the American people are behind Trump. But even more than that, as you rightly point out, Michael, that the law and the Constitution is behind this, because I don't know where we got off on this argument that somehow people who broke our law to get here somehow deserve the protections of our Constitution that is afforded only to our citizens. We have made this argument for too long that anyone within the jurisdiction, meaning literally just here, physically present in the United States, deserves due process. I reject that. People, the 14th Amendment saying, you know, subject to the jurisdiction thereof means citizen. It doesn't mean somebody who waltzed into this country illegally. They can, without due process, be deported. I don't care if they're a violent criminal. I don't care if they're a model citizen. They're not actually a citizen. They shouldn't be afforded due process.
And on that point, Jenna, the tide is turning, and the reasonable or at least self-interested liberals who see which way the winds are blowing, they're getting that. The New York Times ran an opinion column pointing out that the phrase subject to the jurisdiction thereof in the 14th Amendment is not totally clear, and they were weighing in on birthright citizenship, and the New York Times ran a piece saying Trump actually might have a point on anchor babies and the limits of birthright citizenship. And even though the Supreme Court in Wong Kim Ark in 1898 did establish a kind of right of the soil and a kind of birthright citizenship, the Supreme Court has not definitively ruled on anchor babies and the children of illegal aliens and the full meaning of subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So you've got even some liberal institutions admitting this. And why? Is it because they've seen the light all of a sudden? Has the New York Times become reasonable? Not really. It's because the New York Times recognized with the Washington Post that this was a major cultural shift in this election. This was the podcast election. You know, this wasn't governed by the establishment media. The election was brought about to its happy result in no small part by a decentralized kind of media. New people, a new generation, new electoral coalitions. So they're beginning to understand that. And I think even the public opinion polls that you're getting from establishment outlets are pointing out exactly what you've said. Trump has basically strong approval. The vast majority of Americans think Trump is doing what he campaigned on. And when it comes to the deportations, the vast majority of Americans want drastically lower immigration numbers and higher deportation numbers even than we're getting. So when you take all of that together, you've got a good situation for Trump and a weak situation for the liberals led by this judge. The one point I will give them, though, the one serious point that the libs are trying to make is that the court has, through judicial review, the ability to trump the presidency. And a lot of people believe that. A lot of people, even on the right, have believed that over the years because they learned about it in fifth grade civics class. But we also have to remember here that the right of judicial review, that notion that the court has the special role of interpreting the Constitution, that is a self-asserted right. That doesn't come from the Constitution. That comes from Marbury v. Madison. It's a judicial tradition that we've had for a long time. I'm not denying that. But as a self-asserted right, that obviously has limits. The courts do not have a monopoly over the Constitution. The presidency also has fealty to the Constitution. The legislators also have fealty to the Constitution. And the court doesn't get to just run roughshod over the other branches of government, especially when the American people have made their preferences so clear.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you brought up judicial review and Marbury, because I remember talking to one of my law professors years ago and saying, you know, this and making that exact same argument and saying, well, why are we assuming that this self-aggrandized view of judicial review is in line with a power actually given through Article 3? It's really not. And my view of Article 3 and the whole case in controversy is that the Supreme Court, as the court of last resort, only has the power to arbitrate the disputes as to the parties. But this whole idea of judicial review and super precedent, and you know, even these things like district court judges being able to have nationwide injunctions, I mean, none of that is within the actual power and discretion provided by Article 3. That's why they were supposed to be the weakest branch. And so my argument was, you know, well, let's go overturn Marbury. And I think he had a mild heart attack at that point because the law firm was like, no, oh my gosh, you know, this is like since 1803, how could we possibly do that? But I think that the argument is valid that we've given the court far too much discretion. And this is when we're talking about the rise of the administrative state, partly it's not just the political branches, it's also this whole idea that the Supreme Court can tell the states how to run themselves on issues like education and abortion regulation and all of the things that are not given to Congress to legislate on in Article 1, Section 8, and certainly not given to the judiciary to tell the states and to mandate to them what they can or cannot do with their own states' powers. And so we need to get back to that. But it opens a broader question, Michael, that, you know, conservatives have been arguing for a long time, you know, limited government, federalism, you know, conserving, all of those things. That's where, you know, conservatism is derived from. That's the root word and all of those great philosophical arguments. But then there's kind of this new right that is suggesting that since the Democrats are so inconsistent and all they care about is power, as we've discussed, we need to match that and basically have a mutually assured destruction kind of template to say that's the only way we're going to get to a ceasefire. How do you view those two different sides of the coin on the right and where we should go with this Trump mandate momentum?
Yes, it's a great observation. It's the kind of reaction that one can expect in politics when the right has been called Nazis, racist, sexist, all the isms and the ists for decades now. There is a dark but understandable part of the American right that says, well, if you're going to call me a Nazi, maybe I will be a Nazi. I'm already getting all the downside for it. I might as well get the Hugo Boss uniforms and, you know, I don't know, the cool marches or something.
Are we the baddies?
That part that we have to reject that part. You know, we have to be prudent here. You know, we're called to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. So we don't want to allow our opponents to totally trigger us into slapping our nose to spite our face or something like that. But this gets back to something that is in the classical political tradition, and that, which is a big part of the new right, which is questioning some of the ideologies that come out of the Enlightenment, all the way up to the post-war consensus and liberalism. You know, it's good to question those things. It's good to draw on the resources of the classical tradition. Our founding fathers certainly did that, despite liberal revisionists' insistence that the American founding came straight out of some radical Enlightenment textbook. It didn't. I mean, these men were thinking about the great classical thinkers. But going back to the greatest of them, or one of the greatest of them, good old Aristotle, we remember that prudence is the paramount political virtue. We remember, as a more modern philosopher, John Gray, points out, politics is less an argument than a conversation. We recognize that compromise is essential in politics because you can't merely vanquish your opponents, then you'd lose half your country, and that would hurt you too. Talk about smacking your nose to spite your face. So Trump is really the perfect guy, I think, for this political moment, because Trump has made the art of the deal a key aspect of his identity. I don't think Trump is some kind of ideologue. On the one hand, I don't think he reduces politics to five bullet points on the back of a napkin. I don't think Trump is some kind of mad Nietzschean who is going to follow his will to power and become an ubermensch or anything like that. Trump is a really practical guy. And he recognizes that politics is ultimately about the art of the deal. And so Trump, weirdly, in his own person, has aspects that are much more liberal than we've seen in any Republican in recent years. He's a billionaire from New York who was a Democrat who waved a rainbow flag in 16. On the other hand, he has aspects of his personality that are much more conservative and traditional than other Republicans we've seen in recent years. You think about the talk on tariffs, on immigration and deportation, on social solidarity, on the American middle and the industrial base. All of these things are much more conservative than we've seen from a lot of Republicans. So the man's a bit paradoxical. But what does that give us? It gave us a new Republican coalition that includes voters we hadn't been getting before. It includes 1 in 5 black guys. It includes 46% of Hispanics. It includes 40% of women under the age of 30, ostensibly the most liberal demographic. That's a new coalition, a new kind of deal, a new arrangement to, very practically speaking, get things done. You know, politics for Trump, and in reality, is not some abstract science, it's a practical science. And so, you know, the terminally online new right, or the, you know, ideological squishy kind of, I don't know, whatever you want to call them, neocons, bushies, whatever the pejorative du jour is, they're a little too abstract. Meanwhile, Trump is actually getting things done.
Yeah, and that's a great observation, that he is more practical than necessarily exercising prudence, at least in the definition of it being a virtue, of being right and just and true and good, because he is making the art of the deal. And yet, when you say that he's the man for this moment and he's bringing in a lot more of these coalitions to a broader tent, what happens ultimately to the conservative movement when those voters, speaking of not securing the contours or our borders, if we're talking about the Republican Party as having certain guardrails and a platform, like pro-life, for example, like religious liberty, like some of these things, if they come in but they fail to assimilate to conservatism, where does that ultimately lead us?
Yeah, this is the big question for the next 3.5 years. Is Trump is this political genius who has formed a coalition more effectively than any Republican, certainly since 2004. You know, Trump is the first Republican to win the popular vote in 20 years, and really probably in my lifetime. He's just done an amazing job at bringing people to vote for him, the art of inclusion. So the question for us is, is there a Trumpism that continues without Trump, or is it really just about this guy and his singular talents? Right now, J.D. Vance appears to be the heir apparent, though Trump has explicitly refused to name him as such. He was asked, is J.D. your successor? He says, I don't know about that. He's a very talented guy, but there are a lot of talented people. He obviously wants to incentivize people in his administration to keep working to maybe get the tap for 2028. So he wants to keep Rubio on his toes, maybe Pete Hegseth on his toes, Tulsi, Bobby Kennedy. However, it does seem that J.D. is the heir apparent right now. And if it is J.D., I think he will be able to maintain a coherent kind of Trumpism. I think he proved it just this week when he was giving remarks on globalization. And he articulated why our genius elites got globalization so wrong. He took on the chief arguments for globalism head on and spoke from the arguments you hear from Silicon Valley, the arguments you hear from the industrial middle class. He articulated it in a beautiful way, and it showed why he's a good yang to President Trump's ying, is that Trump is a gut politician. He just understands politics intuitively. And he gets into the details sometimes on certain issues, but on others he doesn't need to. He just kind of gets it, you know. We were talking about court precedent earlier. It's kind of like Justice Potter Stewart on pornography. Trump just kind of knows it when he sees it on a lot of political issues. I don't think that's how J.D. Vance came to his political wisdom. I don't think J.D. Vance is a gut guy. I think he came to his political conclusions through rigorous study, through doing a lot of the reading and thinking through it in a really conscious way, which is great because you have Trump doing the thing and you have J.D. articulating what that means. So that's a real opportunity for the future. However, we don't know. It might just be that Trump is a force of nature, and when he goes away, the coalition scatters too.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right on that Vance has come into his political view a lot differently than Trump. And the same could be said of even the Democrat defectors like a Tulsi Gabbard, but also a Ron DeSantis. I mean, so many like me, as listeners well know, I think that DeSantis represents the future of the Republican Party of having the bullishness and courageousness of Trump, but confined still to moral parameters and guided ultimately by biblical principles and constitutional values, not, hey, lawyers, you know, let's try to push this through. And, you know, the Constitution might be in the way a little bit. I know we have to abide by that, but let's get it done. You know, kind of his real estate mogul view on it. So I think that there is an opportunity to build on what Trump is doing, but maybe come back a little bit to a more, you know, guarded conservatism in the future that will build a moral and upright society in a way that we haven't seen in a really long time, especially since the sexual revolution. But I know that we're a little over time here, Michael Knowles. So the last question for you then is, so where do Christian conservatives fit into this mix? Because I also see a lot of people, frankly, a lot of, you know, the people who are disappointed over DeSantis not getting the nomination, but some of these people who see those moral flaws of Trump, and then the people who are just the godless populace that say, I don't care, go Trump. Those two factions are ultimately going to clash in 2028. So where should the winsome Christian conservatives who want discernment align themselves?
Well, I think there's no question that the if you are a practicing Christian and you take it seriously, you have to vote against the Democrats and for the Republicans. Even though the political parties are imperfect and we don't put our faith in princes, the Democrats have just become so extreme and sacramental in their view of child sacrifice and the denial of human nature and the upending of marriage. No one can make a serious argument that a practicing Christian can vote for Democrats right now. Now, it doesn't mean that the enemy of your enemy is always your friend, you know, and there are legitimate fears that we're entering into a neo pagan right or a post-Christian right or something like that. But I don't really see that happening. Actually, I see the opposite. When you look at Pew Research, you're seeing that the decline in self-identified Christianity among Americans has stopped. Christianity as part of an American's identity has been declining for a number of years, and it's flatlined now. It doesn't mean it's growing yet, but it shows that the trend line is changing. Furthermore, we were just talking about J.D. Vance. I think J.D. Vance is a sign of the times. He's helping to create the times, but he's a sign of the times, too. And J.D. Vance, he left the faith. He grew up kind of vaguely evangelical. Then he was sort of secular or agnostic, it appears. And then he reverted, and he has the zeal of a convert. He actually became a Catholic. And I think you're seeing that trend as well. especially among young conservatives, an interest in Catholicism, specifically traditional liturgies in Catholicism, an interest even in Eastern Orthodoxy on the Protestant side, a Reconquista attempt to take back the mainline Protestant churches, which have become so left-wing in recent years, but some Protestants wanting to reclaim those, get back to a kind of Orthodoxy and tradition. You saw this with J.D. Vance when he schooled the Margaret Brennan on the Ordo Amoris, the notion that there's a hierarchy of love, that there's an order of charity. This is part of the real Christian tradition, deep stuff. You know, Gregory the Great wrote about this, Bernard of Clairvaux, St. Thomas Aquinas, quite famously. I see the future of the Christian rite as becoming much more traditional, much sturdier, much more orthodox. And in that way, I think it'll bridge the gap between, you know, the sort of neo-pagan right-wingers who don't want this namby-pamby, effeminate, weak, limp-wristed Christianity. Well, there are now figures on the right who say, you know, Christianity is not really weak. You know, it's blessed are the meek, not blessed are the weak, okay? And actually, there's a great Christian tradition that built up our whole civilization and can defend it again. You can accuse me of hope, but hope is a theological virtue. I think for the Christian right, things are looking very, very good right now.
I love that. And I think that's a perfect note to end this conversation, but it's just the beginning, I think, of this conversation and why the interplay between church and state. And if we look at world history, how that has clashed, how that has built ultimately Western civilization, why we need to continue to build on the fundamental values of not just conservatism in an atheistic or an amoral sense, but ultimately rooted in the Judeo-Christian virtue. Is where we have to go from here. And those are the conversations that we need to have over the next 4 years so that we can be prepared as a movement and as a nation that gave Trump the mandate to continue to then pass the baton and continue that mandate into the future, but hopefully with even more clarity. So Michael Knowles, so appreciate your time this morning. And as always, listeners can suggest topics, guests to my team, Jenna at AFR.net. Of who you want to hear from, what you want to talk about on our deep dive here on Demand.